Introduction to Isaiah. The first talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on September 6, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of the following teaching. During the time lost, Dr. David Crabtree began an introduction to the study of Isaiah by first giving some background information. There isn't a lot known about Isaiah. He was a prophet that taught during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, about 739 BC to 681 BC. Over his 60 years of ministry, he wrote Isaiah, so the sections of writings are over an extended period of time that covered many historical situations. Isaiah was familiar with the royal family and palace culture and had free intercourse with the kings and advisors. He was knowledgeable of what was happening at high levels.
Isaiah was put to death probably during the reign of Manasseh. Manasseh was the one after Hezekiah. Manasseh was one of the wicked kings of Judah. According to tradition, he was put to death. He was put in a hollow log and sawn in two. But that's the tradition. We don't know for sure from Scripture exactly what his fate was. Okay, I am going to spend several minutes now just talking about the political and cultural context of Isaiah, the context into which he is writing. So this will be a history lesson, but I think that it will serve us well and be helpful when we get into Isaiah 1 next week and as we proceed through Isaiah. We're going to have to go way back. I'm going to go back to the Exodus and just very briefly bring you up to the time of Isaiah. There was quite a bit of history that happened over that 600 years or so. But it's important for you to understand how things developed both in Israel and in Judah that are setting up the time of Isaiah. As you probably recall, God led the people of the descendants of Abraham out of Egypt, out of slavery in Egypt, and was taking them to the promised land, the land that he had promised he would give to the descendants of Abraham. He led them out of Egypt through the wilderness, through the desert, and to the southern borders of the land of Canaan, the promised land. He told them to go in and take it, and they said, no, the Canaanites are too big, bad, and ugly for us to do that. So they said, we'd rather not. And God chastised them for that, and said, then they said, okay, we'll do it. And God said, no, don't go now. And they went and were soundly defeated, left after having been routed, and God said, okay, 40 more years in the desert would be good. So he took them back into the desert where they wandered around for another 40 years. And then after 40 years, he brought them up into the promised land by a different route, and they moved into the promised land, and they began to conquer the land from the Canaanites who were living there. In the very beginning, they had a great deal of success in defeating the Canaanites. and they were able to capture all of the key strongholds in Palestine. The people were very eager to settle in and make their lives, start new lives. And so after they conquered the key strongholds, that's exactly what they did. They divided up the land, each tribe moving into a different section of the promised land. And their instructions were to fully occupy the land that had been given to them. They were only more or less successful in doing that. There continued to be fairly large pockets of Canaanites scattered throughout the land that they were unable to dislodge. So there was a period of about 300 years, it was the period of the judges, in which the Israelites are struggling to fully occupy the land that they have been given. They fight against the Canaanites, try to drive them out. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. But more often than not, they have ongoing problems, either with the Canaanites or with some of the surrounding peoples. So God developed this pattern of whenever there was some peoples who were causing trouble over an extended period of time for the Israelites, God would raise up what is called a judge. God would raise up some leader who would say, we've had it, let's go take those people out. And the Israelites would rally around this leader and they would be able to make progress in pushing back this foe. So that was the form of leadership that Israel had for about 300 years. There was no central administration. There was no central government. There was no king. In fact, there was no established mechanism whereby leaders were recognized and given authority. But rather, God would just raise people up and they would rally people to the cause, and the people would follow them, follow that leader for a period of time. So that seems to be the pattern for about 300 years through the time of the judges. Now towards the end of the time of the judges, one of the judges was the priest Samuel. He had been providing leadership to the people of Israel. And he had two sons, both of whom were corrupt. And the people are looking at this and they're assuming that when Samuel dies, one of his sons is going to take his place. And they look at that situation and it doesn't look very promising. So all of a sudden they come up with this great idea. And that great idea is, let's have a king. So they go to Samuel and they say, we need to have a king. Everybody else has one. All the neighbors have them. We need a king. And Samuel's response is, that would be a mistake. Because if you have a king, he's going to build an army. He's going to build a lot of buildings. And in order to do that, he's going to raise taxes. And he's going to put you to work. He's going to take your sons away to serve in his army. He's going to take your daughters away to serve in his palace. It's not a good idea. But the people insisted, and God said, okay. And so Samuel went out and he anointed this fellow who was a great prospect for king. He was real king material. He was very tall, good looking, strong, all that sort of thing. And that was Saul. So Samuel anointed Saul, and he became the first king of Israel. It took him a little while to solidify his political support, but over a period of time, he was able to convince people of his ability to lead, and he was able to lead the Israelites against some of their traditional enemies, in particular the Philistines. that Saul ruled for quite a number of years. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's about 20 years. But towards the end of his reign, he became mentally unstable. And he became mentally unstable because God had withdrawn his blessing from Saul. Saul had disobeyed God on a number of occasions. Interestingly, Saul had disobeyed God when the pressure put on him by the people was intense to do something in one direction when God had told him to do something else. Saul was sensitive to public opinion, and because of his sensitivity to that, he would capitulate to their wishes rather than pursuing what God had told him to do. And on two or three occasions, he is disobedient to God, and so God withdraws his blessing from Saul, and Saul begins to lose his mind. Samuel then goes out and anoints another person to take the throne, and that's David. David had been a promising officer in Saul's army, risen to a place of prominence, and was driven out of the palace by Saul. But David refused to take any action against Saul because Saul had been God's anointed king. And David would not, even when he had the opportunity, he would not lift his hand against Saul to take his life or to drive him out of his position because he was God's appointed king. But after Saul's death, then David was recognized as the ruler, the leader of first just the tribe of Judah. They acknowledged him as their leader. And then, over a period of time, he is able to gain the trust of the rest of the tribes of Israel, is able to unite them all in one unit. He establishes a solid central government. And Saul had been able to establish a rudimentary centralized government. David is able to establish it more firmly. So David becomes a king and is able to put together a kingdom that holds together for the first time. It's a solid unit. And so David is able to quite successfully lead the forces of Israel out against the Philistines and the Canaanites, and is able to extend the boundaries of Israelite control to pretty much what God had promised to Abraham. When David died, there was some dynastic conflict. Who was going to inherit the rule? Who was going to be the king following David? But after some conflict, power was handed over to Solomon. So Solomon became then the third king of Israel. I should point out that while David was king, it was promised to David that his descendants would be on the throne of Israel forever. So that becomes very significant and very important. David's dynasty is established, and therefore it is becomes assumed that it will be someone from the house of David that will succeed to the throne. Solomon becomes king. Solomon continues to expand the boundaries of Israel bit by bit, and Solomon begins to see a greater future for Israel. He begins to see Israel as being a true regional power, if not a world power, but certainly a regional power. Now, it is a curious fact that Israel, from the time that the people first moved into the Promised Land until Judah is conquered by Babylon. Well, I shouldn't take it that far. Until Israel is conquered by Assyria. That's about a 500-year period of time in which there is a power vacuum in the world. That is, there are none of the great powers roaming around the ancient Near East. Prior to that time, there had been some really great powers. Egypt had been a dominant power for centuries. There had been, Babylon had been a great power prior to that time. The Hittites had been a great power earlier. The Akkadians, and there are others. But during that 500-year period of time, there was really a power vacuum. There are no great world powers at that time. So Israel never was a great power. It was a regional power. It came to be a regional power under David and then under Solomon, but there wasn't much competition, and that's what made it possible for Israel to develop and survive. Solomon had great aspirations. He wanted Israel to be a significant power, and he began to develop alliances with other nations, most notably Egypt, and to a certain extent with the Canaanites in Phoenicia, Tyre in particular. And as was the practice during that time, to solidify alliances, you either had another king marry your daughter, or you married the daughter of some other king. Solomon began to marry the daughters of these other kings to solidify his alliances. So he had a number of wives. He began to greatly increase the size of the standing army. He carried on extensive building projects throughout Israel, but in particular in Jerusalem, where he built the palace, and he also built the temple. So for the first time, the temple is a solid building. Prior to this time in the desert, they had carried around this portable tabernacle. And then from our sources, we don't know what happened to that tabernacle towards the end of the period of the judges. It isn't mentioned. Nor the Ark of the Covenant, which they carried on, if you remember, the box that they carried through the desert and into Palestine. And it's not clear at every instant where that box was, the Ark of the Covenant, but David eventually had it carried to Jerusalem. And apparently it ended up in the temple. But Solomon established a permanent site now, a permanent place of residence for God, and that was in the temple in Jerusalem. So Israel is becoming a regional power under Solomon, but to become a regional power costs money. And it costs money of the people of Israel. Solomon jacked up the taxes, and he greatly increased the amount of corvée labor that they had to provide. Now, corvée labor is a term that's used for another means of taxes, of paying taxes. Not everybody had a lot of money, but everybody had 24 hours a day. So the government just claimed a few of those. Everyone had to provide some labor to the government free of charge. So that was another way of increasing taxes. And that was particularly resented by the people of Israel, that their increased corvée labor dues. When Solomon died then, his son Rehoboam claimed the throne. And the people of Israel came to him and said, okay, we're kind of starting fresh here. Let's reduce taxes on the corvée labor. The burden has been too great. Your father was just too hard a taskmaster. Let's just reduce what we have to do. And Rehoboam's response was, No way. I got more building projects in mind. I've got a large staff. They've got to be paid, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a rift that developed within Israel, that the tribe of Judah, which was the tribe from which David came, it was solidly behind Solomon. But the rest of the tribes of Israel said, this isn't working. The kings are coming out of the tribe of Judah. They're showing favoritism towards Judah. It's no wonder that the people of Judah support him. But the rest of us, we're getting the shaft. I mean, it's unbearable. So they broke away. And they broke away under the leadership of Jeroboam. Jeroboam was a fellow who had been employed by Solomon to help on the construction in Jerusalem. And he had been a supervisor, apparently, of some of the construction teams, and was highly respected. He was also a valiant warrior. And a prophet came to him one day and said, you are going to be the king of the other tribes of Israel, all the tribes except Judah. And once the prophet had announced that, Solomon became worried, and Solomon wanted to kill Jeroboam. Jeroboam fled and went to Egypt and waited until Solomon died. But once Solomon died, he came back from Egypt and he led the rebellion against Rehoboam. So we have this split that develops. We have Judah, which ends up incorporating the tribe of Benjamin as well, which was a small tribe. And then we have the rest of the tribes of Israel. Rehoboam is the king of Judah, which becomes known as Judah or the Southern Kingdom. And Jeroboam becomes the ruler of the Northern Kingdom. Now, Jeroboam has a problem. And this is a problem that it's a very interesting problem. It's a problem that has intrigued people in our modern times, probably more than it has intrigued people at any time. And that is, what gives a ruler the right to tell people what to do? On what basis does anyone rule? In the ancient Near East, typically a ruler ruled because they had been appointed to do so by God. That wasn't just true in Israel, that was true in other nations as well. The notion was that our king has been designated by our God to be our ruler. Jeroboam has a little bit of a problem in that the religion of the Israelites, the worship of Yahweh has said that it will be a descendant of David that will rule. Jeroboam has no such claim. Jeroboam does have the word of the prophet that came to him, but he's still concerned that the people of Israel's primary allegiance, religious allegiance, is going to be to the temple in Jerusalem. And if the people are constantly going to the temple of Jerusalem, that is going to authenticate the rule of the descendants of David rather than his own. Let me read you a passage here. You can turn to it if you'd like to. It's in 1 Kings 11:38. I hope that's right. No, that's a different. That's not what I wanted. I want 12:26. Okay, this is a section where it's talking about Jeroboam just coming to be the ruler of the northern kingdom of Israel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David if this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, and the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king consulted and made two golden calves. And he said to them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel and the other in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made houses on high places, and he made priests from among all the people who were not the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month, on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar, thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. Then he went up to the altar which he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 18th month, even in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel and went up to the altar to burn incense. So what he is trying to do is establish a different relationship which will support his rule. He wants to give legitimacy to his position. He's afraid if he doesn't have that kind of religious tradition to establish his legitimacy, then when things get tough, people won't do what he says that they need to do. He'll lose his power. Do you have a question?
But in chapter 11, God's promised him that if he does walk the line, he's
That's right. That's right. God had told him that if he does well, if he is obedient and does what is right in the sight of the Lord, that his rule would be blessed. Mm-hmm. But we've seen elsewhere in the Old Testament, I mean, it sounds very similar to what God told Cain. If you do well, your countenance will be lifted up. If someone is inclined to not trust God, those kinds of promises are not reassuring. And so here we have another instance in which someone, he is not inclined to trust God. God has told him if he does well, God will sustain his rule. But he can't accept that. That's not good enough for him. So what he is intent on doing is taking whatever measures he thinks are necessary, whatever seems prudent to him in his worldly wisdom, he's going to take those measures in order to buttress his rule. That's what he does. So he creates this other religion, and it is curious that he makes these calves. Some have suggested that this is the beginning of a tradition in Israel which says that the calves that were made by the Israelites in the desert at Mount Sinai, if you recall, when Moses went up to the mountain to receive the law and didn't come down for a long time. They were afraid they'd been abandoned there in the desert. They wanted to call upon God. They wanted God's presence with them again. So they made this golden calf and they worshipped it. And worshipped it as the God that brought them out of Egypt. That there is some possibility that what Jeroboam is trying to do is to say, remember what happened there? That was what was right. We've gone wrong since then. So still trying to tap into the ancient tradition of Israel, but diverting it off in a different direction, which would detour around some of the more recent developments in Israelite history, namely the establishment of the Davidic covenant. Okay, so Israel then begins to have this other religion. It often refers to God by the term of Yahweh, but it worships him differently. It ascribes different qualities to him, and he requires different things of the people than the Yahweh of the south, the traditional Yahweh. Furthermore, in the north, there were a lot more Canaanites, so the worship of Baal was much more prevalent. So in the north, we have this other version of Israel's past that is married with the worship of Baal. And we come up with a fusion of those two things into a new religion, or a syncretism. And as a result, as we march through the histories of the kings of Israel, they are consistently described as being evil, doing evil in the sight of God. None of them are said to have been, to have walked in the ways of God.
David, I might,
mm-hmm,
a reminder, people didn't catch it, when you say the kings of Israel,
that's the northern kingdom, right?
That's part of what I want to do with this background, is make sure that we've got some vocabulary straight. From here on, when it talks about Israel, the kingdom of Israel, it's talking about the northern kingdom. The kingdom of Judah is that which is ruled by the descendants of David. That's the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is much bigger. It's wealthier. In many ways stronger, but it's less cohesive. So when it comes to taking joint action, Israel typically has trouble. The southern kingdom is smaller, it isn't as strong, but it's much more cohesive. And it's able to maintain itself just because it's so cohesive.
Mm-hmm. Does the text then follow both kingdoms through the rest of the Old Testament, or primarily just the northern kingdom?
Both kingdoms. Well, as you go through 1st and 2nd Kings, it talks about both kingdoms. It talks about it one king at a time, but it'll switch back and forth between Israel and Judah. 1st and 2nd Samuel talks about the united kingdom under Saul, David, and Solomon. Then 1st and 2nd Kings talks about after it is divided, and it switches back and forth. 1st and 2nd Chronicles also goes back and forth, but 1st and 2nd Chronicles gives much more information about Judah, so it seems to have been written from that perspective. Okay, so after these two kingdoms have split, for a period of time there's quite a bit of turmoil trying to resolve where is the line between these two kingdoms. Are both of them going to survive? Is one of them going to take over the other one? What's going to happen? And there's a period of about 20 years when there's a lot of fighting between the two and a lot of turmoil. But it becomes clear after that period of time that both are going to survive, and the boundaries are fairly well established. And when Jeroboam set up these calves, he put one at the very southern end of his kingdom and one at the very north. And he wants his people to go there and not be tempted to go take the journey further south to Jerusalem. After this period of turmoil, when things are being resolved between the two kingdoms, then there's a period of time in which the northern kingdom begins to get its act together, and at least superficially becomes stronger. And that's under the period of Omri, King Omri and his descendants. And he becomes stronger by developing alliances, and primarily an alliance with the king of Tyre. As he develops that alliance with the king of Tyre, his family intermarries with the family of the king of Tyre, and we have the introduction of Baal worship in a purer form than it has been before. It's after Omri that we really begin to see a heavy influence of the worship of Baal in the northern kingdom. Jezebel was a daughter of the king of Tyre. But Israel prospers, and they develop these alliances, and because they begin to do so well and prosper, Judah begins to develop friendly relations with Israel. And in fact, the daughter of one of the kings of Israel marries one of the sons of the king of Judah. And they enter into an alliance. Then they go to battle together against, and I can't remember who they're going to battle against. Escapes me at the moment. But Israel and Judah jointly went to battle against someone, and the king of Israel and the king of Judah were killed in that battle. So there was turmoil then. After this period of relative stability, there's turmoil again. There's revolution in the north. There's revolution in the south. Both. It takes a while for the north to become solid again, with under the rule of one king. In the south, it is briefly ruled by this daughter of the king of Israel, who was a devotee of the worship of Baal. But then she is put to death, and there is reformation in Judah following this revolution. Okay, so after these two revolutions that break out both in the north and the south, things settle down once more. The north gets its act together again and begins to prosper economically. Judah, slowly, it reforms itself religiously, and then it begins to prosper as well. So both are prospering, and they are not in an alliance at this point in time, but relations are not too tense between the north and the south. And that's the time when Isaiah comes on the scene, when he first comes on the scene. Now, I'm going to talk just a little bit about what follows just a few years into Isaiah's ministry, just so you have some idea of where we're going. At the very beginning of the time when Isaiah is prophesying, things look really rosy. Israel is doing very well economically, but there are signs that there are some social weaknesses. There's a huge disparity between the rich and the poor. There are tensions developing, social rifts that are beginning to appear. But they aren't very obvious. For the most part, things look pretty good. And there are no external threats, immediate external threats. But soon after Isaiah begins to his ministry, the Assyrians begin to move west. And the Assyrians are not nice guys. The Assyrians are one of the first nations to use cruelty as a military weapon. There's a strategy that's used by peoples after them, but they seem to be the first ones to have really developed it. And that is, if you are really brutal, if you go to a city and you say, capitulate or we'll crush you, and they say, we are not capitulating, then you go in and you are absolutely savage. When you go to the next city, it's a little easier. The chances that they will capitulate are a little better. The Syrians developed that strategy as they marched, as they increased their empire, especially as they moved west. They're a long ways away from Palestine, but they begin to, in Palestine, they begin to hear hoofbeats in the distance of the Assyrians coming. So the king of Israel says to the king of Judah, let's form an alliance. And let's form an alliance not only between ourselves, but also with the Aramaeans. There'll be three of us against one. Those have to be pretty good odds. The king of Judah said, no, I don't want to be any part of this. So the Aramaeans and the Israelites attacked Judah and were defeated. Judah, meanwhile, the king of Judah, appealed to the Assyrians and said, we've got these two pesky countries bothering us. Will you be our protector? And Assyria said, sure, for a price. And Judah was willing to pay that price. So Judah becomes a kind of tributary then to Assyria. Soon thereafter, Assyria continues its march west, easily destroys the Arameans, and then easily moves into Israel, destroys the kingdom of Israel, establishes a puppet kingdom there for a while. Then that puppet kingdom rebels. Assyria comes back and says, we've had it. We don't want to mess with puppet kingdoms anymore. We're making this part of Assyria. They deport all the leaders of Israel to other parts of the Assyrian Empire, and they take leaders from those other parts of the Assyrian Empire and move them to Israel. So the northern kingdom then is this mess of cultures. There are some Israelites there, but there are lots of other people mixed in as well, and it develops a whole new religious tradition, a whole very syncretic religion. The south is able to hold off Assyria. At first, as I mentioned, they were tributaries to Assyria. Later, they decided that the payments to Assyria were too steep, and they stopped making those payments. So Assyria came to collect in earnest and destroyed most of Judah. But before they were able to take Jerusalem, something happened. It's not clear exactly what happened, but the whole army fled back to Assyria. And so Judah was spared. And then, as you probably know, a few years later, then Babylon came and conquered Judah. So it's that period of time from this ending period of prosperity. People don't see it as ending. They think things look really good, or look really rosy. That's when Isaiah begins his ministry. Then he continues his ministry for 60 years, which carries him through the time of the attack of the Assyrians. What does Isaiah say to the people of Judah in particular? He's really addressing all of the descendants of Abraham, but obviously it's most focused to the southern kingdom. His message is really very simple when you boil it down. He says, you people are rebellious against Yahweh. So he says, repent. And if you do not repent, then what awaits you is destruction and purification. You're going to be wiped out, and God is going to use that destruction as a purifying agent. A remnant will remain, and God is going to do something really remarkable with that remnant. So that's basically, when you boil it down, at least as far as I've gotten in Isaiah reading ahead, that's essentially his message. Now you can imagine the response of the people of Judah to this message. Keep in mind, they're human beings. So their first response is going to be, who, me? Repent what? Repenting is hard to do, as we've learned recently in our national life. We're all human beings, and our natural tendency is, I mean, we go through our entire life making sure that everything we did was justified. It was either our parents or our genes or, I mean, who knows? I mean, there are all kinds of things that we come up with, but there's always something else to blame for our wrongdoing. And our mind is constantly churning, trying to figure out how we can place blame elsewhere. I mean, that's just the way we are as human beings. So when Isaiah comes and he says, repent, their first response is going to be the response of any human being, and that is, of what? What I do? And they are worshiping Yahweh. They are not heathens like their brethren to the north. For the most part, they are continuing to worship Yahweh. They go to the temple. They say their prayers. They offer their sacrifices. They're doing what's required of them. So they look at their lives and they're saying, things are fine. We're doing what God required of us. Now, it's true they're doing other things. They're worshiping other gods on the side, but that's their private life. In their public life, they're worshiping Yahweh. They've got this way of dividing things up. So what if I go worship Baal a little bit? I'm still going to the temple when I'm supposed to be there, etc., etc. One of the themes, the drumbeats that you hear in Isaiah is, but what about justice? What about doing what's right? Do you do that? What about the poor? What about the widows? What about the orphans? Do you take care of them? What about the people who are unjustly charged with something? Do you care? Does justice matter to you? Does it matter to you that some things are inherently right and some things are inherently wrong, and that yearning to do that which is right is valuable? That is consistently what Isaiah keeps hitting on. He hits on it from lots of different angles, but that's his theme. It's essentially the question, where's your soul? What's happening in your soul? I think of, we'll talk about that next week. So what the response of the people is, first of all, their natural defensiveness that any human being would have. Their rebuttal, but we're worshiping Yahweh, just like he said that we should do. We're doing what he says. And Isaiah is saying that Judah risks being destroyed. Well, they can look at the promises given to David and say, that doesn't seem to fit. There will be a descendant of the king of David on the throne forever. How can Judah be wiped out? In fact, as they think about that, what Isaiah is saying is undermining morale as the threats begin to grow. As we get into Isaiah, the outside threats begin to grow. What Isaiah is saying could be construed as undermining the position of Judah by destroying morale. So the question that has to come to their minds is Isaiah a false prophet rather than a prophet? And sort that out. It'll be interesting as we go through here. I have found it very thought-provoking in the chapters that I've looked at so far. He is really asking the question, what is the state of your soul? What do you value? What's important to you? And the key question is goodness, is righteousness valuable to you? Because if it isn't, then you're a rebel against God. You're not just slipping up, you're a rebel against God. And that's what has to be sorted out. Are you or are you not a rebel? And the other theme that comes through is, despite everything that Isaiah is prophesying will happen to Judah, he goes on to claim that Judah's role in history is going to be greater than you even imagine. Judah is going to have a truly fabulous role to play in history. And God is faithful to the promises that he made, starting way back with Abraham and all the way through. He is faithful to the promises that he has made to Abraham and his descendants. Okay, so we'll start looking at those themes as we march through Isaiah starting next week. Questions, comments?
Micah? What is Micah's business?
The prophet Micah? The prophet Micah is prophesying at about the same time. It is interesting that several of the passages in Isaiah are either very similar to passages in Micah or identical. The wording sometimes is identical. So Micah is prophesying at about the same time to the southern kingdom. Other questions? Comments? Yes?
Can you read about that information about the choice of cows? As far as owls, I know that some of other religions hold cows very sacred. I just wanted to understand the background of where that came from.
You're wondering why did they make the golden calf as opposed to a golden turkey or something else? Yeah. I don't know. There is speculation that in Egypt, the Egyptians had the notion that God would come and rest on the back of a calf. So there were golden calves that were made in Egypt, and it was thought that that became the seat of God. So in the wilderness, it makes sense then that the descendants of Abraham, who have been enculturated in Egyptian traditions, that when things get rough, they say, well, how God has gone away. I mean, Moses was with us here, and as long as he was here with us, we had someone that we could go to, and he would pray to God, and God responded. But Moses is gone. He's been gone for 40 days. He's obviously dead. And so we have no way of gaining access to God anymore. So they're thinking, well, what do you do? Well, I remember. You build a golden calf, and God comes and sits on it. So that's my best guess as to how to reconstruct that. That they're just drawing upon the tradition that they knew and employing that. Well, now Jeroboam, he wants to create a religious tradition that he can use for his purposes. But there are advantages to having it tie in to their tradition. So he's looking back, rummaging back through his memory of Israel's past, and he says, there is something I can latch on to. Let's go with those golden calves. That's part of our tradition. We will establish those. That's the God that brought us out of Egypt. That's just my reconstruction. Yes?
In Egyptian polytheism, popular goddesses was Hathor, who was the goddess of home and hearth. Even in polytheistic cultures today, she's still very popular. You want to have food and keep the family happy. Right. And so a lot of people pointed to the cow. She's a cow. Right. Worship is a cow. And so a lot of people think they were exported the most popular goddess of their region.
I couldn't hear that.
Well, Hathor, in Egyptian culture, one of the popular gods. They were polytheistic, but one of the popular gods was Hathor, which was envisioned as a calf in Egyptian culture, and it's possible that they borrowed that because it was a very popular god, the god of hearth and home. Anything else? Yes?
At what point did Judah start getting corrupt?
Well, Judah kind of goes in cycles. If Israel can be characterized as consistently evil, the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah can be described as being some very good and some very bad. We have early on, the kings are not great and tending towards pretty bad and getting very bad. Then we have the reforms that take place, and we have several kings that are described as being good kings. But after each